Bird Language, Reading the Concentric Rings of Nature, with John Young.
All right, we're beginning tape three in Advanced Bird Language, Reading the Concentric Rings of Nature. And the focus of this tape is on how we grow as bird language practitioners. I guess if that's what we can call ourselves, maybe a better way to refer to us is scouts in training. And I don't mean Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. I mean scouts like the Native Scouts that used to watch for danger and protect the tribe. How bird language works into this whole thing, and how bird language changes us is the topic of this tape, and also the routine of invisibility, a review of that concept as the primary device that we use to actually alter the way we approach the forest. I'd like to begin by telling you briefly who Tom Brown is, who Stalking Wolf is, and who I am, just quickly, just to kind of introduce the... I've been dropping their names here and there throughout this whole tape series, and I really wanted to give you an opportunity to know them. If you've never read any of Tom Brown's books, it would be a good idea, if you're interested in these subjects, to definitely get out there and read some of these books by Tom Brown Jr., The Tracker, The Search, Awakening Spirits, Grandfather, The Way of the Scout, and a whole series of field guides to nature observation and tracking, to survival. I really recommend Nature Observation and Tracking. After listening to this tape series, you'll want to read that book 25 times over and over again really slowly because there's so much in there. Stalking Wolf was a Lipan Apache from the southwest of this country who was a scout, one of the last scouts of his people's hunter-gatherer traditions, who never entered into the reservation life. He never slept in a house. He couldn't really stand reservations. They felt like prisons to him. But more than that, he had a vision of what were the universal teachings common to all the native people that were really important for human beings to learn. When you strip away cultural values, when you strip away religious ideas or maybe what we might call ceremonial dogma, things that are important only within the context of a very specific tradition. He was always searching for the things that were universal to all people. And he was 83 when he ended up in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, and he was taking care of his own grandson, Rick, and Rick's best friend, Tom Brown Jr., who were both 7 at the time. From the age of 7 to the age of 18, Tom was mentored by Stalking Wolf in these ways of the scout, which heavily hinges on the art of tracking. And Stalking Wolf believed greatly that of all the survival skills that someone could practice, it seemed to him that awareness was the most important physical skill. He emphasizes this today, that is, Tom does, in all of his lectures and classes, that awareness is the most important physical skill. Bird language is one form of awareness. Tracking is another form of awareness. And really, Tom doesn't see a separation, and I really don't either. In the long run, these all merge to become one skill. In a native hunter-gatherer society, in the way that Stalking Wolf was raised, these weren't taught separately, but they were taught as part of a whole integrated way of life. So Stalking Wolf, at the age of 94, passed away back in his home territory, and Tom picked up where Stalking Wolf left off to continue these teachings. And I met Tom Brown when I was 11. Actually, I was going to turn 11 that summer. I was 10, and it was June, and I turned 11 that summer in August. But Tom and I spent many years together from 1971 till 1978, when he opened his school and wrote his first book, The Tracker. So I ended up as an instructor there at his school at the age of 18. So this stuff has been passed on to me, similar in the way that Tom learned it from Stalking Wolf. As Tom likes to say, I'm the only student he's had the luxury to train the way that Grandfather Stalking Wolf trained him. So that's how this knowledge comes to me. And really, as I said in the tapes that we have already recorded, the first two tapes, that it was the birds and my secret spot and my routines that really taught this to me. And Tom represented a source of inspiration and a coyote teacher, someone to constantly ask me questions and to bring me deeper. So those are the mentors in my lineage, if you will, or my tradition. In addition to those two mentors, I've also mentioned Ingwe, who you should know about him as well. You could get more information on Ingwe from Wilderness Awareness School, but he was raised among the Akamba people in Kenya, East Africa. He was born in 1914, and he was raised there speaking their language, and they were his friends growing up, and they're a hunter-gatherer nomadic tribe as well. So a lot of the things that Ingwe learned growing up from the Akamba are very similar to the things that Tom learned from Stalking Wolf that I learned from Tom. So when Ingwe and I met in 1984, we realized that we had a common vision and a common ideal to raise youth, to mentor them in these methods and teachings. So Ingwe helped me with Wilderness Awareness School starting in about 1985 and right up until about 1995 when he took a break because he's now at this point in his 80s and is having a difficult time getting around, but he's very much in spirit the grandfather of Wilderness Awareness School. He has a fascinating life, and you'd probably enjoy reading about Ingwe in his book called Ingwe, I-N-G-W-E. I also mentioned Gilbert Walking Bull, and he's been very important to the Wilderness Awareness School as well. We consider him a founder, and just recently has been named that because of his commitment and following of his own traditions. He was raised with his own language in the rural districts of Wambly, South Dakota, and he grew up with 22 medicine people around him who had all gathered there to escape the Christianizing pressures of the missionaries and the government. So he grew up in an unusually dense cluster of what you would call holy men and holy women who were his teachers as he grew up. He had to teach himself to read and write English in his early 20s and has written 4 books on his traditional teachings, his people's teachings, which are considered very authentic works and are often used today in Lakota schools to teach the children. Gilbert has a great interest in what he calls the sacred path, the teachings of the Inipi, which you might know as the Sweat Lodge, and its effect on people's growth. And he's also very interested in the sacred ways of his people through the what's called the Chinupa, or the sacred pipe. So Gilbert has done a lot of workshops with me, and we've taught a lot about bird language together, so he's influenced a lot of what you're hearing as well. And he currently lives in Washington and runs an Inipi society out there at Washington State as part of Wilderness Awareness School's greater community. So those are some of the people that I've been mentioning. And I also wanted to mention someone whose name is going to come up in an odd context later. His name is Merv Wilkinson, and he's the author of a book called Wildwood, A Forest for the Future. And Merv, we have named the fifth profile of our bird language profile. We've named it Mervana in honor of him, and obviously it's a play on words, but some people think I don't know the difference between Nirvana and Mervana, but we call it Mervana in honor of Merv Wilkinson. So if you want to read more about Merv, please look him up. I've just given you the information there, so you can do that. Okay, so I thought I'd start off just by telling you a story about a gray fox and a wren. Where I'm from, the area where I was mentored to become a tracker, there are a lot of Carolina wrens. And I've always been curious as to why in the middle of winter they suddenly burst out with their spring song, their summer song. And I always suspected it was an alarm because it was so out of context. And it was always loud enough and it carried with it a feeling that sounded alarming. Didn't sound like their normal song, but it was the song phrases that if you heard it on a bird tape, you'd say, yes, that's its song. It wasn't its call note that it was using as an alarm. I noticed this because they would sing out of context in these sudden bursts that seemed to always be associated with other bird alarms, and then they would stop. So it wasn't like they were singing territorially. They seemed to be singing for another reason. I noticed this over and over again, and one day I had the opportunity to figure out exactly what was going on. I was walking below the dam at Marlow Twitchell Farms, which is now a county park in Monmouth County, New Jersey. And I was following down the stream, as I often did, looking at the tracks of muskrats and things along the creek shore, finding some mink tracks and sign, and generally enjoying the deer population and exploring and otherwise wandering around, when I heard that alarm go off in a very specific location up on the edge of a hill. It was a south-facing hill, and in the January winter there, it was a little microclimate of warmth. There was always little gnats hovering around. Even though it seemed to be 20 degrees outside and cold, there was these little places where it was warm enough for the birds to still be flying. So I noticed this area there seemed to be a place where the wrens like to hang out, because I knew that they were eating spiders and insects in that area from having watched them. So while I was walking down in that direction one day, in that one little microclimate where the honeysuckle vines were thick, where the wrens seemed to hang out, there was an animal trail that led right through the middle of it. And after I heard that alarm sequence go off, I walked over there to see what it might be, and I found fresh gray fox tracks right there on that trail. So the next day when I came back, I was walking by that same place, and again, this time from behind me, I heard the same alarm sequence, and again I went in there and found fresh fox tracks, these fresh from today and not the day before. So I began to realize that this wren was giving its alarm call whenever the gray fox snuck away from me. And I also saw this as an opportunity to get close to the gray fox. So the way I did that was I walked down the trail, I spooked the fox out of his usual hiding place. He snuck through the place where the wrens were hiding. The wrens went off and gave their alarm. But instead of walking in the direction that I normally did, I double backed on myself and went over to the place where I knew the fox was headed by his patterns from the 2 days before. And I set myself up in a good place where I could see down over the edge of the hill. And sure enough, coming from the place where the wrens had just alarmed and moving in a sneaky posture, looking over his shoulder back at me, where I wasn't really there anymore, was the gray fox. And he was slipping along using the tree roots as his cover. So that's how I learned that sometimes songs out of season or songs out of context can sometimes be alarms. So don't always think that alarms are limited only to call notes. Sometimes the song can be used as an alarm, especially out of context like that. Wrens in general, you should recognize, are excellent alarm birds. They follow all the criteria that I've already mentioned. They have brown coloration. They live close to the earth. They always live in thickets, and they always seem to be in places where other things are. For instance, the fox and the wren seem to be associated, and mainly because of that little ecological niche of warmth and sunshine that warmed that one little valley, that one little place in the valley, so that the insects were still mobile. Because the insects were mobile, there was probably shrews and mice active in that same location and other birds, and of course that drew in the fox. So always look at wrens as a bird that could be a useful bird alarm source for you. I also wanted to mention yellowthroats for the same reason. They choose similar habitats to wrens, although they're only here in the northern climate. They're only here during the spring, summer, and early fall. But they're also excellent birds for learning their alarm calls. Their song is easy to get to know. Their call note is real distinctive. And you could really benefit a lot from getting to know yellowthroats. I think that if you're from North America and you have a secret spot that has any kind of thicket associated with it, you'll definitely get to know the yellowthroat. They're very territorial, and they're real interesting in that they do a circuit around the outside of their territory, so you could actually watch them tracing the lines of their territorial boundaries as they move around singing. Another bird that would be important for you to know is the red-winged blackbird, because there's so many of them per acre in a big swamp where there's lots of life. Red wings really will teach you quickly how to tell territorial behavior and also how cooperative alarm behavior can be. They are extremely vocal. They demonstrate their feelings with their body language and with all kinds of behaviors that are really easy to read. The female looks extremely different from the male. She seems to be about a third smaller than the male, and she looks like a big sparrow, whereas the male has got that flashing red and yellow patch on his wing. So red-winged blackbirds, because they're so vocal and they're so available, are really good teachers. They will certainly let you know when you're getting close to their territory, and they'll teach you all about territoriality calls and how they defend their nests just by you walking up on them. And for the same reason, the thrushes of the northern latitudes are also worth getting to know. from the wood thrush to the hermit thrush, the varied thrush, and the Swainson's thrush, all these different members of that thrush family are good alarm birds, as well as the bluebird. They're all related to the robin, and they have the same characteristics, being very vocal and very expressive and very territorial. And they're all ground feeders, with the exception of the bluebird. But the bluebird is a good hedge feeder. You know, he's always on the edge of the hedges, at the edge of the meadows. His voice is very distinctive as well. So these are some birds that I just wanted to throw out there for you to get to know. And also, you may have heard legends of the raven and what the raven offers as far as alarms go. Ravens have to be one of the most confusing birds to get to know. They have one of the most complex languages of any living animal on the earth. So you don't really want to spend a lot of time trying to understand ravens. But if you really did want to understand ravens, you might try reading a book called Ravens in Winter, and that will give you a good solid warning as to what it might be like to learn the language of ravens. Ravens have long been known all across the northern hemisphere, even in Europe, to be friend to the hunter, and also the hunter's worst enemy, potentially. And the Apaches, for instance, practiced a particular custom that whenever they killed a deer, they always left a certain part of the deer kill for the ravens, because the ravens were the ones who always brought the hunter to the game. And this is known of wolves as well, that ravens are working together with wolves, that they are known to bring wolves to game so that the wolves can make the kill, and of course the ravens benefit from that. It's also said among the Apache that if you don't leave offerings for the raven, that the raven will get to know you as an individual and then make you have bad luck by warning the deer that you're approaching. So whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I do know this, that birds are certainly capable of recognizing individuals. That's very evident. And that they are capable of doing so, that will come clear in my story about the great horned owl later. So listen for that. But remember that birds do recognize individuals, and the one story that really emphasizes that is the story of the honey guide in Africa. The honey guide is known to bring an animal called the honey badger right to the bees' nest, the local wild honeybees, and the honey badger will thank the honey guide accidentally by tearing apart the hive, getting what he wants for food, and leaving stuff scattered all around, which the honey guide, the little bird, gets to feed on afterwards. So this honey guide is figured out by using vocalizations and demonstrative body language that he can call honey badgers to the hive, and then the honey badger benefits from that, and of course the honey guide does. Now, the honey guide will also come to people and do the same demonstrative body language and try to lead human beings to the hive, which the Africans have long known and respected. And even if they themselves aren't ready to collect honey, they'll still follow the honey guide and break open the hive for it and run away so that the honey guide can eat, because they have recognized through time that if you're, like, say, Joe the hunter, and you walk up to this hive and break it open, that the next time the honey guide sees you, Joe the hunter, it will bring you to the next hive. But if you decide not to bring the honey guide to the, or if you don't decide to break open that hive for the honey guide will remember you. And the next time Joe the hunter walks up, the honey guide will ignore you. So it actually is capable of recognizing individual features enough to say, oh, I'm not helping him anymore because he doesn't help me. So Ingwe heard that growing up, and he tested it out and found it to be true. So I would recommend to you that you don't ever for a minute think that birds aren't capable of recognizing individual characteristics in human beings. And one of the things I'll talk about in the routine of invisibility later is ways in which to enhance the bird's ability to get to know you. Because there has been a lot of questions asked of me over the years, don't the birds just get to know you? Won't they trust you? And the answer is yes, but there's a process involved there. You can speed the process up, though, and that's the whole secret to invisibility. Last thing I thought I would leave with you specifically is house dog alarms. House dogs are an awful lot like people, and I mean modern people. So when a house dog blunders into the forest, and I mean blunders because that's the behavior that it exhibits, it causes agitation alarms in the birds, but they don't take the house dog very seriously. So if you're ever out there and you hear like these sort of bursts of alarms coming out that sound more like agitation than true alarm, and they seem to be moving around you in a sort of scattered manner, and you hear a lot of sound associated with feet falling on the ground, you're probably looking at a house dog approaching. You know how fast they move in the forest. It's very easy to recognize a house dog alarm as it's approaching. So I would share one more story with you and then dive into the continuum from Homer Simpson, the stalking wolf. And I'll start by saying that here that one of my favorite stories that Ingwe has told me is the story of the elephants and the killdeer, or the plover, I should say, because I don't think it was a killdeer in Africa. But there was he observed once a whole line of African elephants moving through the country, and he noticed that a little plover came out of its nest and began to drag its wing like it was injured, and it made all kinds of noise and kept flying up in the face of this great matriarch elephant that was leading the herd. And they were headed, their trajectory was right through that bird's nest. And so the bird was having a heart attack, more or less, flying up at this elephant, flying up at the elephant. And this elephant leading, you know, a couple of dozen other elephants behind it had absolutely no reason to listen to this plover. I mean, if you think that animals are selfish and that's all they think about, this really illustrates what Ingwe calls, you know, the whole etiquette of the wilderness, that these animals all really respected each other when it was possible. And in this case, what happened was that lead elephant brought her ears forward, grumbled a little bit with this low rumbling sound, and kind of swung her head from side to side and studied the landscape in front of her, spotted the nest, realized what was going on, and then gave a certain call, and then actually detoured all the elephants around that plover nest. So all the elephants actually went around that nest because the plover more or less requested them to stop and go around. And that shows you the kind of etiquette that is out there among the animals in times of peace, if you will, that they do really respect each other's space. And you have to understand that that is the key to understanding invisibility, that we can't, A, assume that birds are so dumb that they'll never recognize individuals, and B, that there isn't some kind of honor and respect among these animals, even in between species. It's not, I mean, it is hunter and hunted for sure. That is a big part of the story. But during the downtime or during baseline, etiquette really does play a role here. And it might be, from a scientific point of view, just looking at it as conservation of energy again. It might just be that simple. But then again, it might be that animals actually respect each other. Who knows? I mean, we can't see up their eyes, so it's hard to know. Okay, and so that brings me to a question that was asked, why do we anthropomorphize birds? And, you know, is this just soft science, you know, poetic? You know, is there any scientific validity in it? And my answer to that is, well, if there's any validity to tens of thousands of years of experience, you know, as evidenced in the hunter-gatherer nomadic abilities in terms of their hunting ability, their ability to get past bird alarms and interpret bird alarms, there must be some cause and effect going on here. They do use anthropomorphic techniques to understand bird language. They literally say, and I've been told ever since I was young, to put my mind and my eyes right into the mind and eyes of the birds and look out through its eyes as if it was me. And if that is anthropomorphic, then, and if that's a fault, it's a worthwhile fault. And maybe it's not 100% accurate from a, you know, a data collection point of view, but it certainly helps you to learn a lot quicker than if you were just strictly using a very objective scientific method. So I believe there is a value in becoming empathetic in your approach to this. It may not hold up in rigorous scientific testing, but I think that's okay too, because if you're out there to learn this, you're out there to learn it. Whatever works, works. You know, it's in a way, to me, it's like learning art or it's like learning music. You have to use your heart and your empathy in order to get the most out of the experience. You can't strictly be logical and observe in a very detached manner. There has to be some investment on your part from your heart in order for this to work. So, yeah, I guess in that sense, I am admitting that there is a soft scientific aspect to this. But I will say this, that in all my years of doing this, I have made some very objective observations of who succeeds in this and who doesn't. And those who succeed are certainly those who adopt a empathetic point of view in their study of this information. So if I can apply science to the observation of who learns and who doesn't, then science says that those who use an empathetic approach learn faster than those who don't. So that might be worth mentioning. So there's value in it nonetheless, either way. Okay, I've already said that when the average person walks along, that essentially I think there's a, you know, I'm going to read into their mind a little bit and say that it seems to me that they don't perceive that there is any bird alarm thing going on whatsoever. There's no order to nature. Maybe nature is just a bunch of random stuff happening that they're not really part of. And I think that that assumption is a sort of background operating assumption of Western experience. We're not really taught that there's something to be respected outside, you know, that the birds have a value other than just as entertainment. So that when we walk through the forest, we don't really think we're disturbing anything. Even people who have been taught to not kind of walk up in their elder's face and yak in their face or disturb their parents when they're working or talking quietly, obviously in an important discussion, people who learn to respect people's boundaries like that don't necessarily automatically know to respect birds' boundaries. They don't make that assumption. So when they're walking along outside, you know, as far as they're concerned, they have every right to be there and they'll just kind of plod along. Well, because they have no knowledge or awareness of bird language at all, they essentially create alarms in front of them continuously, and those alarms just build up as a great big tunnel of silence around them. And because of that, things like bucks and does and foxes and bears have plenty of warning to get out of the way and hide. So people can live near a patch of woods and walk through it all of their life, every day even, and never know that there's a bear living in it, or never know that there's an old buck living in it. And that's because it's the buck's choice whether or not it's seen. And from all warning signs that the buck is receiving from all the bird language around it, you're a dangerous person because you're being treated like an extreme hazard by the birds. And so there's a lot of animals that choose not to see you. So the other extreme of that, which almost seems like a fantasy novel, are the people like Merv Wilkinson who can walk through the forest and get right up close to bears and bucks and see all kinds of things, and the bucks kind of begrudgingly get out of his way as he's walking through. What is it about Merv that makes him like that? Or is Merv just, you know, telling stories and that really doesn't happen? Well, I had a good friend, an instructor at the Tracker School, Mark Tollefson, sort of verify for me that the animals did seem to have an amazing relationship with Merv, because he was walking behind him at some distance one day in the forest and he noticed that there was a pileated woodpecker feeding on the side of a tree. And Merv walked right by it, didn't give the woodpecker a second glance, just looked at it briefly, and the woodpecker didn't even give Merv a second glance. And at first, Mark thought that the woodpecker didn't really care too much about Merv, or maybe it was just sort of blind to him or something. When he started to approach the woodpecker stopped its feeding, looked right at him, and made a squawk and flew off. So he realized that the woodpecker was discerning between Merv and himself. And he made that observation, and I've heard a lot of stories about Merv coming back and saying that he was out on his walk and, you know, there was a bear feeding right in front of him. So how come Merv can get away with that and we can't? Well, that's the kind of the two extremes. There's that sort of, I don't think anything's going on in the woods that I have to pay attention to attitude. How come I don't see any wildlife? There is no wildlife here, as the one extreme. To the other extreme of, you know, someone who walks in the forest and gets to see the most shy creatures of the forest. And Stalking Wolf, of course, was capable of seeing amazing things in the woods, as was Tom Brown. So the other thing you might wonder about is, okay, I'm a bird watcher, so you got these tapes because you're interested in birds and you've been watching birds for 10 years or 20 years. How come I don't know this stuff? How come I don't know what you're saying is true? Well, I want to point out that I was trained as a bird watcher in my teens, the emphasis was always on identification of birds, okay? Saying, okay, I've seen the common yellowthroat now, and I've seen the yellow warbler, but I hear another bird call out there. Oh, it's the black-throated green warbler. I'm beginning to hear that call. Now I want to see that one. So, and then once I've seen the black-throated green warbler, it's okay, well, I hear the scarlet tanager singing. I haven't seen that yet, so I'm going to go and search out the scarlet tanager. So it's like a goal-oriented approach. Now, something like a robin, which is in your yard, is the first thing that you learn as a bird watcher. So it's kind of like, cool, a robin. Oh, wow, neat, I can identify a robin. But once you've gotten past that point, the goal is reached. You don't really need to look at the robin anymore. So in bird watching, where your goal is to fill your life list with as many birds as you possibly can, and some people go to enormous expense to do that. They fly all over the world to do that. Something like a robin or a song sparrow, which is an everyday bird in your backyard, is no longer the quarry. It's no longer the goal. And so you begin to ignore them. What I'm actually saying is the approach that we're using is the exact opposite. It's not that the tanager has no value or the black-throated green warbler has no value. It certainly does. Everything has a value out in nature. But what I'm saying is that it's extremely important to get to know the robin as if it was your best friend, or almost like a pet or a neighbor, a co-inhabitant that has information for you that's very important. So that's kind of the opposite approach. And it is, for a bird watcher who is really, really interested in seeing as many species as possible, taking this approach is kind of, maybe you would consider it boring. So there is a way to compromise there. And that would be to keep your binoculars on your lap. And when you're sitting out at your secret spot and really trying to get to know the robins and the song sparrows around you very well, whenever you hear a new bird enter your territory that you haven't seen before, well, go get up and go stalk it. You know, but in the meantime, don't sweep the song sparrow under the rug as if it has no value, because that's how you learn. I mean, bird language, as I said to you before, it took me 7 years to learn this. 7 years of sitting in the same place every day. These birds became my friends, literally, my relatives. The other thing is, you're not really going to find this in books. This information isn't really out there in books. You'll read it between the lines in Tom Brown's books. If you read Jim Corbett's books, you'll read it there. If you read Ingwe's books, he mentions bird language and what it taught him. But you're not going to find it in the field guides. You'll hear them in the field guides mention the song and the call, and they might even say the alarm note. But they're not going to talk to you about the specifics of this, because this hasn't, as far as I know, been written up yet in any books. It also doesn't exist on the bird tapes themselves. They don't explain this on the bird tapes, because the bird tapes are primarily aimed at identification to help people fill their life lists. So there's a different goal to the tapes. The kind of tapes or CDs that would support this would be the kind of tapes that the entire side A is all robin songs and robin calls. Here's a robin when a cat goes by. Here's a robin when a dog goes by. All those different kinds of calls. That's the only way that this could be supported by CDs or tapes. And so I recommend to people, if you want to learn bird alarm knowledge, bird language knowledge, the five voices of the birds, you more or less have to make your own tapes. And I've recommended over and over to people that if they want to learn the robin really well, that they should, you know, make tapes themselves and dub over and over from their bird song CDs or tapes the same robin's voice over and over and over on the whole side of the tape, so that they just internalize that. When we learn bluegrass music, we talk about saturating our ears with the same songs over and over again. It's the same process. You just saturate your ear with one or two species until it's starting to play over in your mind, like you're starting to hear it instead of commercial jingles. You can replace the spot in your brain that's filled with commercial jingles right now with robin calls and robin songs. So you make one tape. One side of it is all robin sounds. The other side of it is all song sparrow sounds. You probably want to edit out the voices of the people who are telling you what's on the tape, because that voice will really get irritating. And the last thing you want is that person's voice to be part of your subconscious brain repeating itself over and over. That'll drive you nuts. So what I've done and what I've recommended in the past is, you know, you have the CD at home. Lang Elliott has wonderful CDs, as does the Peterson series. There's a lot of good tapes out there. You know, to get a couple of different sources, make a tape that's all robin sounds on one side and all song sparrow on the other, and talk to your friend who's learning the same thing you are, and have them work all on wren and red-winged blackbird sounds, so then you guys can trade tapes when you're done, because it is very time-consuming to make a tape like this, but it's really worth it. And I'll tell you this, that if you learn three or four birds in this fashion, then learning the other birds will come a lot quicker. You'll train your brain on how to learn bird sounds just from doing this. There's some excellent resources out there that'll help you along the way. Birder's Handbook is a fantastic one. The Field Guide to Bird Behaviors by the Stokes, Donald and Lillian Stokes, they're excellent. There's about three volumes that talk about bird alarm behavior. That'll help you. And the new Peterson guides that get really specific about different bird groups like warblers and things like that. These are excellent. And there's also some really good videos available from Audubon Society, as well as CD-ROMs that show you the birds singing. So, you know, you're supported out there. You got a lot of information that will help you to get to know the birds. But remember what I said, you know, start by just learning, you know, 5 birds, maybe 10 at the most, and really concentrate on 1 or 2. That's the best way to go about this. Okay, so nowadays I've learned my lesson, and I have to travel alone if I want to see wildlife. And it's basically, I've observed this over and over again, that when I'm traveling alone, the birds treat me one way. When I'm traveling, even with another person who's a naturalist or a tracker, that doesn't guarantee that their profile is where mine is at. And so basically, the weakest link in the chain is what's served out there. If they don't have much dirt time, they don't have the practice, they're obviously doing something, and I can't even tell what it is, because they seem to be doing everything I'm doing physically. But we have an entirely different experience out there. So if I want to see things, I have to travel alone, and I think you'll discover that in time too. If you really want to get close to wildlife, you got to go alone. And I think the only way that would change is if you and, like, you know, like, I like to look at Tom and Rick as an example, and the tracker, those two were like inseparable. They were always out there together. I think if you spend all your time outdoors with someone else and then you learned all these skills together, that would be the only way that you would be able to travel with somebody out there and have the same kinds of experiences. Because I imagine that a group of Apache scouts traveling through the landscape, you know, 200 or 300 years ago probably would have had really rewarding experiences, because they all learned how to be invisible through their childhood. And I think that's the key here. You'll also notice some unusual things happening when you get out there and do a lot of this kind of stuff. You might begin to notice that you're having repeated experiences with the same animal over and over again. You might take them for granted. I was about 18 when I started exploring a certain forest over by Rutgers University, and I encountered a great horned owl that didn't fly from me. It wasn't afraid of me for some reason, and I could get very close to it. In fact, sometimes it was just about 10 feet over my head on a low branch of a beech tree, and I could sit down under that tree and spend a half a day just sitting there, and I would imagine myself looking out through its eyes. What would it be like to be a great horned owl, I would think, you know? And the chickadees would come and visit the owl while I was sitting there, and it would come and get mobbed by jays, and I would get to see the whole thing, but it was almost as if I wasn't there at all. Although I knew the owl knew I was there because it kept looking at me, but it never seemed frightened of me. I made sure that I always wore the same shirt, because my reasoning was that that camouflage shirt and sweater that I wore and the brown pants that I wore were kind of like my plumage. And so I figured maybe this owl is recognizing my plumage. So I made sure I always wore the same clothes each time so I wouldn't confuse the owl. I'd tell people about this owl after having spent 3 or 4 hours sitting under the tree. And I would go back to my dorm room, and they would say they wanted to come see this owl because they didn't believe that I was seeing an owl that close. So I would try to bring him back, and of course the owl wouldn't be there. And that was so frustrating for me, because they began to think that I was just pulling their leg. This went on for a couple of weeks, when finally this young lady named Debbie came up to me and said, "Oh, I really want to see this owl. I believe you. Will you take me to see it?" And maybe it was just her sheer sweetness that was affecting this situation, but I brought her to see the owl, and sure enough, it didn't fly away. It was there when I got there, and she was able to then concur with me on this owl back at the dorm, and she rescued my reputation. Or they probably thought I paid her off so that she would say she saw it, but she was able to go see that owl anytime she wanted also after that. So there seems to be things going on in nature that I can't really explain, that certain people are kind of accepted by certain animals, and those animals make it a regular point to visit them. And this will probably happen to you. It's probably already happening to you, because everybody that I've mentored through the years has had something along those lines. After a while of being out there, they started to notice that they had synchronicity with certain animals or birds. I remember reading in a book called Native American Running that the hummingbird, if it came to you and visited you in your dreams or in your physical, your waking life, that you were a great runner in Native tradition. I don't know how these things work. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And I just kind of filed it away in the back of my brain, and I never really did anything about it. But I did then later run into a man at a gathering in the west over in the Rabbit Stick Rendezvous. And I saw him running, and his running posture was beautiful. He had essentially mastered what Tom Brown and I call coyote running or fox running. He was absolutely beautiful. The way he ran, his head didn't bob up and down, and he was obviously conserving energy, and he had mastered what I would call native running. So I spoke to him later. I found him, and we talked, and I said, boy, you have really done an amazing job with your running style. And he said, oh, I did? I said, yeah, it looks really, really good. I just finished teaching a workshop on that, and you absolutely demonstrate everything that I was talking about. And he said, wow, yeah, well, the reason I did that was because I practiced Tai Chi, and I also love running. And so I figured maybe there was a way to merge my love for Tai Chi with my merge for running, and I kind of figured out this style of running. And my goal is to run 100 miles in one 24-hour period. And I thought, well, that's neat. What, you know, how close have you gotten? And he said, over 40 miles. And I said, well, you're approaching what the native mailbag carriers used to do, the runners that ran from village to village. You're really on it. And then into my mind pops the hummingbird, so I have to ask, you know. I said, hey, by the way, have you ever had any unusual experiences with hummingbirds? And he wrinkles his face, head up a little bit, and he says, not unusual. And I'm like, aha, he has had experiences with hummingbirds. I said, well, do you ever have experiences with hummingbirds? Oh, yeah, all the time, he said. I said, all the time? Oh, yeah, well, I go to my area that I sit. I have this little canyon that I sit in, and I like to sit there, you know, pretty much every day and kind of meditate after my Tai Chi workout, and the hummingbirds are always flying around me. I said, really? He says, yeah, well, this hat that I'm wearing, they seem to be attracted to it. So they're always flying right in front of my forehead, just kind of hovering right there. And I said, oh, really? He's like, yeah. I said, will you ever dream about them? He says, oh, yeah, all the time. I'm always dreaming about hummingbirds. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I'm just kind of thinking to myself, maybe he doesn't realize that not everybody dreams about hummingbirds, you know? And then the last thing I asked him was, so nothing unusual. He says, well, you know, actually there was something unusual once, I remember. My Tai Chi sash was over my leg, and this hummingbird flew over and picked it up and started pulling on it, tugging on it. I kind of thought that was unusual, but that's the only thing that ever happened that was unusual. And it's amazing to me how many people have synchronicity with animals like that and don't realize it because they begin to think that it's a normal everyday thing. I don't know what that is, but let me just say that it might happen to you. And I remember once there was a circle of about 30 people, and I had mentioned this very same story that I'm mentioning to you here. When I said, like, for instance, who here ever has experiences with foxes? And this woman raises her hand, and before she thinks about it, she starts to say, oh, yeah, all the time, I'm constantly running into foxes. And then she looks around and realizes that no one else's hand is raised. And that of 30 people, she's the only one who has fox experiences, and not just fox experiences, every single time she's in the forest, she runs into a fox, and she thought that that happened to everybody. So why these things happen, I can't say. But I will say this, I believe it has something to do with the projection that as you're a person who learns bird language, it begins to alter who you are. The birds begin to kind of give you a signature in a way based on your body language, your approach, the feeling that's around you, and that signature begins to invite certain experiences in the forest. That's the best way I can put it. You know, I've been tracking mountain lions and bobcats for years, and I have seen a mountain lion in the distance from a car once, and I've seen another one kind of snake off once out of the corner of my eye, but I've never had a close encounter with a mountain lion. I've been right close to them and known they were there, tracked them and heard the bird language, and even said there's one living in that place over there, and then later on someone walked in and squirted it out, but I myself never get to see them. I accept that. I don't really take it on as a self-esteem issue or anything. You know, I've learned to accept that. But I do have amazing synchronicity and abilities to get close to foxes, coyotes, and wolves, which is an unusual thing. Some people spend their whole life looking for wolves and never see them, and I run into them by accident. So how this happens, I don't really know. But I have, you know, just encountered someone recently in California who is terrified of mountain lions and who in just a short time, in a few weeks, encountered 6 different incidences of close encounters with bobcats and mountain lions. And this is just driving to and from her home or seeing them around her home. And I've been going to that place for 3 years and have been tracking both the mountain lions and the bobcats at that same place in California and never saw any of them. So this is just the way these things work. As I say, I don't create the universe, so don't blame me. I just track in it, and I'm aware that these patterns exist. So that's all I'm going to really say right now, so you're going to have to turn the tape over to hear the rest of this thing.